go to the next page. If any time you cannot hear me well, please speak up. I can slow down or I can go closer to the microphone. So let me begin by telling you how this talk originated. Well, the organizers of the 11th Marshall Grossman Conference had asked me to summarize.
Hello, this is Madrid.
Who joined us?
Yeah.
Who is it?
This is Guillermo speaking.
Okay. Guillermo, we just started and we are on transparency first. The text transparency, okay?
Okay.
Origin of the talk. The talk originated because the Marshall Grossman meeting organizers asked me to both summarize some of the recent advances in quantum gravity, but also address some of the concerns that have been raised by outsiders, people working in string theory, supergravity, etc., about the status of the program. Well, it is a bit awkward, and I consulted a lot of people, but finally I accepted, because it is important to have our viewpoint recorded in some official setting. And I also wrote to a lot of colleagues and received a lot of input from them. The talk itself, I might have to confess, was not the most pleasant one. But on the other hand, I think the whole was a useful exercise. So Jorge suggested that I give an expanded version, just the frequently asked questions part of the talk. I'm not going to talk about the recent advances at all. And the hope here is that maybe we'll have a lot of discussion and it will sharpen what I said. And so the main idea for is to get the feedback from our community, broader community. As in any large and healthy community, I know that different people look on them gravity. That's like somewhat different views on various issues. That's perfectly fine. But I hope that this talk will serve as a vehicle to develop a broad consensus, the successes and challenges of our approach. In this talk, rather than waiting till the very end, I will stop at various points and we can have discussion in that part of the talk. This transparency begins the first point. It is often raised, and it has to do with quantum correction. People often are surprised, even people using the denormalization group flow approach and so on, are surprised that we actually begin with just Einstein's equations. In other words, just classical Einstein theory with a cosmological constant and some matter fields. And then we go over to a background independent non-perturbative quantization. So the question is really, one often is a misconception that because of the way we proceed, in our approach, Einstein's equations remain completely unchanged. The question is, shouldn't Einstein's equations get quantum corrections? And the answer is yes, they should, and they do receive quantum corrections in loop quantum gravity. Just to clarify matters, it is useful to just consider the very well understood theory of quantum electrodynamics. And there, one does begin with the classical Maxwell-Dirac action, and then one proceeds with quantization. With any approach, one could use path integrals, or one can go back to the old operator approach of Schwinger. This is what one does. And one does not argue that the classical action itself must be modified because of quantum correction. But once one has finished the quantum theory, there is an effective action, which if you like is written as though it just has classical fields. And this effective action, which in principle is supposed to incorporate all quantum effects, it shows that there are all sorts of additional terms to the effective action which represent quantum corrections. And therefore, our viewpoint is very similar in loop quantum gravity. We begin with a standard classical general relativity or supergravity, but Einstein's equations do receive quantum corrections. And in fact, I would certainly expect that the effective action that one may have at the end, which would be obtained by coarse graining, would exhibit not only corrections, but certain non-localities at the Planck scale. A concrete example of quantum corrections is provided by quantum cosmology. In the classical Einstein theory, the Friedmann equation is just double constant square, that is to say, A dot divided by A whole square, where A is a scale factor, is equal to 8 pi g rho by 3. There is a typo, rho is missing there. This Friedmann equation is replaced in the simplest model, isotropic homogeneous model, with an equation which looks like A dot over A whole square is equal to 8 pi g over 3. Again, rho is missing. 8 pi g rho over 3 times 1 minus rho matter or rho critical, where the critical density is given by a certain constant. And note that the Barbieri emergency parameter gamma appears in this expression in the cube power, and I'm going to come back to this a little bit later. And the numerical value of this critical density is about 0.8 times the Planck density. So the precise form of the quantum corrections actually leads to profound departures from general relativity in the Planck regime. For example, in the simplest models, because of the minus sign, there is actually a repulsive force, and therefore the Big Bang is replaced by quantum bounce. Next, transparency. next topic is a larger one, and after the end of this topic, we can have discussion on both the first topic, which is corrections to the quantum Einstein's equations, and second topic, which is ambiguities in the Hamiltonian constraint. Let us begin with ambiguities then. The question is, isn't there a large number of ambiguities in the dynamics of loop quantum gravity as of today? And the answer is yes, indeed. And these ambiguities are well known to the loop quantum gravity community for quite some time. I say this because several people have felt within the community that some of the outside reviews often convey the idea that they are finding some things which are not known to the loop quantum gravity people. But this is certainly not the case. For example, in the review paper that Jurek and I wrote, we have a very clear discussion. A discussion which is not hidden or anything, very clear discussion about these ambiguities. And these ambiguities are precisely the feature which reflects the incompleteness of the current status of loop quantum gravity. But I would like to sort of go a little bit more detail. Some of these ambiguities, so let's go and look at the ambiguities. Some of these ambiguities correspond to factor ordering. But these kind of ambiguities of factor ordering are also present in ordinary quantum mechanics. They are partially reduced by the requirement that the constraint should be self-adjoint because we want to pass the physical Hilbert space by a suitable group averaging. In quantum cosmology, for example, one can see that some of these ambiguities are actually are taken care of by this requirement, but this requirement still reads certain factor order ambiguities. And very detailed, explicit calculations have been done, both analytically and numerically, to show that the remaining factor ordering freedom does not change the qualitative predictions of the theory. Only some details change, and really relatively minor details have changed. Therefore, there is a reason to hope that the situation might be similar in the full theory, where only some the general features may be robust, and the changes would be in the details. The second kind of quantization ambiguity of the Hamiltonian constraint. Next transparency, please. It is associated, and this is a more significant one, is associated with the representation J that one uses, that one assigns to the new edge that is added in the Hamiltonian constraint. This does change the constraint qualitatively. For example, in quantum cosmology, Kevin van der Sloot has analyzed this issue, and he has shown us that, in fact, one gets a higher order difference equation, which therefore will have many more solutions, and many of them would be actually spurious. In other words, would not descend down to the physical sector of the theory. But Alex Perez has given arguments which are tight in the three-dimensional quantum gravity and are still somewhat have open ends, loose ends, in the four-dimensional quantum gravity. But these arguments indicate that we should really use the fundamental representation J equal to 1/2. So if you do that, then of course we would not have these ambiguities at all. So I have discussed two kinds of ambiguities, factor ordering ones. I'm not saying they're not important, but in the examples we have looked at, the factor ordering ones do not change the qualitative picture, and the ambiguity associated with the representation, which does change the qualitative picture, giving us a higher order equation. But I think there are arguments to believe, and they could be sharpened, and they should be sharpened, that we should just restrict ourselves to J equal to 1/2 representation. And the last set of ambiguities is kind of more, less under control. Namely, there are ambiguities associated with the choice of triangulation, with the treatment of non-Euclidean part of the constraint. The non-Euclidean part of the constraint that is treated so far would also typically lead to higher order equations. And the question is whether there is some other way to handle this non-Euclidean part of the constraint, which it leads to higher order equations because it involves, so to say, the double points of brackets. And at present, these are not controlled and require more work. For example, I do not understand the physical ramifications of these ambiguities. So in my view, fresh approach, for example, involving gauge fixing of the Gaussian diffeomorphism constraint. So this goes against the spirit of what we have been done so far, where we preserve the diffeomorphism invariance when we go to the quantum constraint, but at the cost that everything is very non-local, we don't have physical observables, we don't have a metric, but only a diffeomorphism class of metrics and so on. And if we can do suitable gauge fixing in large chunks of the classical phase space, we might understand various sectors of the quantum theory in the traditional language of metrics and so on. Then the second nice way of looking at quantum dynamics would be derivations from spin forms, and also the discretization schemes a la Gambini and Pulley. And I think these kinds of approaches, alternative approaches, should be pushed aggressively. Let me go to the next transparency, because it still continues with ambiguities. The question that one often asks is that in the current approach, the constraint algebra cannot be verified in quantum theory. Is this not a fatal drawback? Well, I think that logically, there is nothing wrong with this strategy. Indeed, we could first impose the Gauss constraint, solve it, obtain the physical Hilbert space with respect to this constraint. On that Hilbert space, go to the second step of defining the diffeomorphism constraint and solve it. Then again, by group averaging procedure, we'll get the Hilbert space, and then on that Hilbert space, we can define the Hamiltonian constraint and then see what happens. If this procedure leads to a theory with rich semi-classical sector, it would be a viable physical theory. And I think it will be worth trying the systematic procedure in the 2+1 dimensional theory. There is an early paper by Thomas Tima. There's also some unpublished work that Jurek and I had done. We did not publish it precisely because of Thomas's paper. But using these ideas, and one could also do it using spin forms, one could actually see if such a procedure does not work. My belief is that it does work, and we do get a large space of solutions in which there is actually the semi-classical, the usual sector, the so to say the Witten sector, and therefore all the semi-classical states we would like to have. However, in practice, to resolve these ambiguities and have a we have a better chance if in fact we require the satisfaction of the constraint algebra already, so to say, at the kinematical level. So this, to be able to really have operators corresponding to quantum constraints and show that there is a closed quantum constraint algebra could well be a very useful tool to, for example, address the ambiguities that we have. But this step, in my view, is not essential. Let me go to the second question on this transparency. And the question is, aren't these ambiguities just a reflection of the ambiguities associated with the perturbative non-renormalizability of Einstein gravity? My view on this is not at all. My view is that the perturbative non-renormalizability is, and our ambiguities have entirely different origins. Our ambiguities arise from incompleteness of our current understanding, and as time goes on, we have more and more experience with models and more insights with spin forms and discrete approaches and so on. We might actually be able to get rid of a large number of these ambiguities and analyze the physical ramifications of the remaining ambiguities. But the perturbative non-renormalizability really has to do with the inadequacy of the Gaussian fixed point of the renormalization group flow. Next transparency. In this transparency, I'm continuing the discussion about the previous point, namely the difference between perturbative non-renormalizability ambiguities and the ambiguities that we have at the current stage of loop quantum gravity. So, for example, the distinction between the two is brought up again by 2 plus 1 gravity. And 2 plus 1 gravity is really non-renormalizable. If I were just to do a standard, I meant non-renormalizable, not renormalizable. There is a typo there. 2 plus 1 gravity is power counting non-renormalizable. And in fact, in the early days, rather distinguished field theories have written published papers saying that because of this, 2 plus 1 gravity is as hopeless as 3 plus 1 theory. But we know that this model is exactly soluble, and in particular in loop quantum gravity. I think it will be really good to compare and contrast the perturbative problems and the exact solution. The Madrid group in particular, a few years ago, compared and contrasted the perturbative and non-perturbative treatments for this model coupled to a scalar field. They did not use loop quantum gravity in detail, in the sense that they did not use the treatment of constraints, say, a la Thomas, but they did use a connection wave. I mean, one can use and the connection formulation of this theory. But what they did there was to really solve the theory using cage fixing. But we should really understand the difference between this perturbative non-renormalizability and the non-perturbative exact solubility in this model. The second point is really that there do exist perturbatively non-renormalizable but exactly soluble models also in ordinary field theories having nothing to do with gravity. For example, the so-called Gross-Novo model in three space-time dimensions, which is a model with n fermions and with a UN symmetry in the model. This model admits a non-Gaussian fixed point. Now, initially it was thought that because the model is not renormalizable, there will be technical differences which will show this non-renormalizability. People believed that the correlation functions will be worse behaved than the tempered distributions that arise in the perturbatively renormalizable model. But it turned out that indeed this turned out to be false, the temper, the correlation functions are as good as in the perturbatively renormalizable model. So, upshot is that perturbative non-renormalizability does not say very much about the non-perturbative existence and non-perturbative features of the model. The last point in blue is that by now, in fact, there is significant evidence that Einstein gravity also admits a non-Gaussian fixed point, and this is a work with a whole bunch of authors, especially by Reuter, and I think I forgot to put Max Niedermayer's name in this list. Max and Reuter are writing a detailed review on this subject. And furthermore, they really have the significant evidence that the theory may therefore make sense non-perturbatively. So this is just standard field theoretical type treatment during Euclidean gravity. And furthermore, there are some qualitative similarities between their findings and between spin forms and loop quantum gravity. In particular, the effective space-time dimensions in these models, in this renormalization group flow analysis, the effective space-time dimension at Planck scale appears to be 2, exactly what we would say it is in the spin-form models and loop quantum gravity. So this concludes the first two topics. The first was about whether quantum gravity does not receive quantum corrections beyond Einstein theory. The second was about the ambiguities in the Hamiltonian constraint. So I would like to stop here for a few minutes to have a discussion just on these two points before going on to the third point. So please, comments, questions, discussion.
This is Jorge. I have a question.
Yeah.
So in Yang-Mills theory, for instance, when one defines a Hamiltonian on the lattice, there are also huge ambiguities. I mean, you can represent the magnetic field by taking a little loop around one plaquette or take seven plaquettes forming an L or whatever you want. And the resulting theories are all different in principle. It's just that when one sort of takes the continuum limit, they all agree, and that is largely because the theory is renormalizable. Doesn't that suggest that because of the lack of renormalizability in the gravitational case, one could be stuck with these ambiguities that are not, I mean, are not factor orderings in their origin?
I mean, so we don't know, right? We don't know for sure. However, again, with this non-trivial, with this series in which there are non-trivial fixed points, right? For example, this gross number model in three dimensions. It is also done by putting the things on lattice to begin with, and then taking the continuum limit. And again, the statement is in the continuum limit, the ambiguities of this kind that we talk about go away, right? But even though the model is non-renormalizable. So I do not believe that renormalizability is a necessary condition for the ambiguities to become irrelevant operators in the final theory. But I agree with you that one would have to wait and see, right? I mean, the program is extremely incomplete in this direction, and this criticism I completely agree with, that the program is very incomplete. But whether there are substantial ambiguities that remain, and I don't mind if there are some ambiguities that remain, but the question is whether they can be physically understood and they are controllable. That is to say, there are not infinitely many of them. Do you want to comment further, Jorge?
No, that's fine, thanks.
Any other comment? Yeah?
Willem Wester from Utrecht speaking. I was wondering whether the Gross-Neveu model also can be solved by loop quantum gravity techniques, and whether you can obtain the same answer as by standard techniques by using loop quantum gravity.
I do not really know. The reason why, personally, not the community, but shy away from these things is really the following. In models in which there is actually a background metric, the use of loop quantum gravity techniques, which is really adapted to diffeomorphism invariance, is a total overkill and is even inappropriate because the models do have a background metric structure. There is Poincaré invariance, not diffeomorphism invariance. and then to use a kinematical structure which is not geared to the symmetries of the model does not seem to be appropriate. The only case that I know of where there is a larger symmetry group, not a Poincaré group, so to say, is really two-dimensional Young-Mills theory, where the action is invariant under the area-preserving diffeomorphism group, which is an infinite-dimensional group, not just the Poincaré group. And in that case, I think it is appropriate to apply loop quantum gravity techniques. And these were applied some years ago, in the mid-90s or late 90s. And what we found was that the theory gives you, I mean, the loop quantum gravity techniques in this case give you good results. Not only not that, but at least at that time, and even perhaps today, that paper is the only one which gives closed expressions for all Schwinger functions in this in the two-dimensional Young-Mills theory for arbitrary loops, loops with arbitrary topology in two dimensions, I mean, many intersections and so on and so forth. So I feel that wherever there is diffeomorphism invariance and no background metric or no background fields, the technique loop quantum gravity is well suited. To apply it to circumstances where their Poincaré invariance is important seems physically inappropriate and mathematically tedious to me.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure. Any other questions, comments? Okay, so let us go to the third part. The third set of questions for the next transparency. And the third set, the third issue has to do with assessing progress. So the question here that is often asked in these reviews and in private conversation is the following.
Hello, Abai. This is Marseille. We had a problem here. We wanted to ask a question. Can
okay,
we
go back?
To,
yes, okay. Please go back. Okay.
Here is Carlo.
Hi, Abai.
Hi, Carlo. Go ahead.
It's not a question. Just I wanted to add a comment. I agree with everything you said, and I also agree with what you put as your point of view that the ambiguities in the definition of the theory are most presumably unrelated to the ambiguities of the normalization theory of a non-normalizable theory. What I wanted to say is that it's more an idea how to check this in the future. So I wanted to connect this discussion with the low energy calculations we're trying to do, starting from the pin form and the loop of gravity. Hello, Is that fine?
We can hear you.
Oh, you can hear me. So I think it is possible to check this directly by if one can go ahead with the calculations of the endpoint functions from the theory. Because these calculations can be done in the standard linearized, the old-fashioned quantum field theory way. And of course, everything can be done except that one has an infinite number of free parameters in front of all the terms. And if we succeed to do the same calculation, I mean, computing endpoint functions from the non-perturbative theory, then the hope is that we're just supposed to get the same term, basically expansion on the Planck length, and see whether the ambiguities that we set translate into ambiguities in the free normalization parameters or not. And so this is, I think, one of the main motivations for doing the endpoint function calculations that several of us are trying to do.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you, and that is a very, very positive direction. It will enable us to confront this issue head-on rather than just giving general answers to it. In this respect, I again want to sort of say something that I already said about the work of the Madrid group. They were not using loop quantum gravity techniques. They were using gauge fixing for the exactly soluble model and so on. But still, 2 plus 1 gravity coupled with a scalar field, I think it will be good to understand, and they did work on this, the difference between what happens to the correlation functions and everything, the perturbative treatment, and how the non-perturbative treatment changes this. And so I would really, really feel that it would be very nice to have a seminar at the Madrid Group in this series very soon. Okay, so Carlo, I completely agree with you. I think that is a very, very important project. Let me now go on.
Abai, this is Alejandro. I just wanted to add a little comment. I wanted to say that, I mean, I agree with all what has been said. And this is probably one of the most important problems that we are facing. But it is my feeling. I mean, it seems to be clear that this has to be done in the pool theory somehow, because in Lukács cosmology we can already see. It seems to me that these ambiguities will affect these coefficients in the effective action that has infinite terms. So that there is a correlate, there is a direct link between the ambiguities we're talking about and the coefficients in the effective action of models with finite degrees of freedom, such as the one in Lukács cosmology.
Yeah, I agree. Anything else?
No, it was just that comment.
Okay, so let us go to the third topic, which has to do with assessing progress. And as I was saying, the question here that I put is really a question that is both implicit or explicit in some of the reviews. And in fact, when I gave my talk at Amsterdam, they had heard a previous talk, a review talk, on loop quantum gravity, an outside review, so to say. And they were all under the impression that the status is the one that is reflected in this question. And that is why I would like to address it head on. So a lot of people seem to be...
Abai, speaking from Utrecht. Can you stop a second, because we have a kind of a nasty echo here in the line. Can everybody check whether the microphones are switched off, except for Abai?
Yeah. All other places, Marseille included, please switch off the microphone, otherwise there is an echo on the line.
Okay, thank you very much, Abai. I think you can go on.
Okay. So the question is, if a definite Hamiltonian constraint has not emerged yet in loop quantum gravity, could one not say that there has been very little progress since the Wheeler-DeWitt theory, Wheeler-DeWitt geometrodynamics? In fact, in one of the reviews, it is said that there is a regression, that the Hamiltonian constraint here is more complicated than that in the Wheeler-DeWitt dynamics. So there not only has not been much progress, but there is, so to say, a regression. Well, I think it's, to me, I mean, I'm going to answer this in several stages. But first, it is clarifying to compare the situation about assessment of progress with that in string theory. In string theory, perturbation theory is really known to diverge. This was the result of Gross and Perival in the 90s. Early 90s, and furthermore, it diverges uncontrollably. That is to say, it is not Borel summable, so you cannot resum it by using some other technique, which means that if we ask a physical question in string, perturbative string theory, such as what is the amplitude for the graviton-graviton scattering, the full answer in perturbative string theory is actually infinite. Now, one may say that this also happens in quantum electrodynamics, and why should we worry about the convergence of the entire perturbation theory? If we don't worry about in quantum electrodynamics and quantum electrodynamics works, why should we worry about in string theory? But as we know, quantum electrodynamics is incomplete, and we all know that we should not trust his predictions beyond some degree, some first few terms in the perturbation theory, for example, first 137 terms. I just put that number down because of the inverse of the coupling constant, basically, terms in the perturbation theory. However, a theory which claims to be complete, which really takes supposed to take care of all the ultraviolet problems, cannot take this refuge, saying that you should go to a better theory. And therefore, the standard belief in perturbation in string theory is that we should not trust the perturbation theory in string theory, the full answer. We can only trust one or two terms. And non-perturbativity effects are actually crucial here. But this was realized almost two decades ago But still, we have only a skeleton of the candidate of the non-permittivity M theory. Therefore, one could say the same thing. To me, if you were to ask a physical question, calculate some physical effect. And if the answer is ambiguous or infinite because the theory is non-renormalizable, or if it is infinite and ambiguous, if the theory is actually term-by-term renormalizable or term-by-term finite, but the series diverges, to me, both are equally bad. I mean, at the in the final analysis, not technically equally bad, but in the from the physical point of view, equally bad. And so here also the statement is that one might say that the problems faced by the perturbation expansion in string theory, namely the convergence problems, say that there will be also problems in the non-perturbative level. But this is not the general viewpoint. The general viewpoint is that, in fact, we did make progress beyond, quite a bit progress beyond supergravity because of various things that are on the next transparency. I'm trying to argue that if you look at this analogy and assess progress kind of equitably, then I think one would have to say that there is also substantial progress in loop quantum gravity. Before going to the next transparency, I just want to make one technical comment, which I'm surprised by, but which I've heard several times now. Namely, one often hears that in string theory, the perturbation theory is finite order by order. However, this has really been checked explicitly only to the two loops. Even the three-loop calculation in string theory has not been really completely checked. And the second thing is that apparently there is now mounting evidence that n equal to h supergravity, if you look at it perturbatively, then it may be perturbatively, it may be perfectly fine. The counter terms will cancel up to five loops. So the whole subject about even term-by-term, status of the term-by-term perturbation theory is up in the air. This was a side remark. Let me go to the main point, which has to do with assessing the progress in the next slide. So the next slide continues, which I think that in both cases, there has been considerable incompleteness, and there is a diversity of ideas, but there is also considerable progress. Some consistent frameworks have emerged, and special cases have been well understood. In loop quantum gravity, for example, there is a strong uniqueness theorem on the kinematical framework, which, to me at least, is very powerful and surprising. Then there is also a good understanding of the geometry of quantum horizons in equilibrium and the statistical mechanical derivation of the entropy. There's also the spin-pone models also have led to a fertile approach for obtaining the graviton propagator and effective low-energy theories along the lines that Carlo was just telling us about. And furthermore, probing non-permittivity aspects of Young-Mills theories, there have been these papers by both Laura Friedel and others, and work in progress by Florian Conradi. And this is very nice. This would be very nice to continue to also make contributions to Young-Mills theory from our point of view. And the final thing is that the dynamical ideas have been tested in detail. Tested is missing. Dynamical ideas have been tested in detail in mini superposed spaces, and one has found physically desirable results, including singularity resolution. So there is huge incompleteness, but the statement is that there has been definitely significant progress and beyond the Wheeler-DeWitt theory. I'll stop here for questions, comments, particularly comments. Any comments?
Hi, this is Fernando Barbero from Madrid.
Yeah.
I would like to add that it is important to stress that the thermal-facing invariance has been taken care of in this framework, and that is something that could not be done in the ADM Wheeler-DeWitt geometric dynamics. I think that's another very strong point of the framework, and I think it's important to realize that.
That's true. I mean, that there is actually a Hilbert space. The group averaging could be done, and there's actually a Hilbert space on the space of the space of solutions to the diffeomorphism constraint. I agree, Fernando. Anybody else from elsewhere? If not, there is a comment here from Penn State.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I completely agree with the formulation on this slide here, because I mean everybody agrees that string theory is incomplete, but I'm not sure that the reason for it is that the perturbation theory doesn't converge. I mean, if you can also define you can also have well-defined theories like an anharmonic oscillator, and if you do a perturbative expansion of it, you will not get a series that converges, but instead an asymptotic series. Likewise, if you take well-defined lattice gauge theories, you can get a perturbation series that is asymptotic and not convergent. So in string theory, the problem is that you have no non-perturbative theory that, or you don't know the non-perturbative theory that is supposed to be approximated by the perturbation series. But it's not incomplete because you don't have any convergent perturbation series.
I don't think I disagree at all. In fact, that's exactly what I was saying, that the incompleteness, in fact, it is said here that because of this, the standard belief is that we should not test first perturbation theory, and we should go, the non-perturbative effects are actually crucial. But almost two decades, we only have a skeleton of the theory. So I'm just comparing the situation in the two in the loop quantum gravity and string theory. But I agree that the important thing is, of course, whether there is an anharmonic oscillator or lattice gauge series or various other cases where things work well, there is a non-perturbative treatment, and we don't have it here. Okay, so let's go to the next transparency, which is the last but one topic, I think. Topic number four, which has to do with spin forms, black hole entropy, and loop quantum cosmology. So here are a bunch of questions. One question is, much of the work in spin forms is carried out in the Riemannian context. That is to say, we assume that the space-time signature is just positive definite, but this is not the usual Euclidean theory that people do, from which they think one can make a Wick transform. This theory in spin forms is a Riemannian theory, the plus 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 signature theory in its own right. In the action, one uses e to the is, if you like. One actually finds the Hilbert space of states as though it is just a standard theory, and so on. So much of the work in spin form is carried out in the Riemannian context, which has no simple relation to the physical Lorentz sector. There is no Wick rotation involved. Why is this interesting? Well, I think that it is very interesting because it addresses long-standing problems in a background-independent fashion. Just as interesting mathematical physics comes from ADS-CFT conjecture, which assumes unphysical boundary conditions. And in fact, this situation in switch spin forms is better because unlike ADS-CFT, the Riemannian spin forms directly suggest strategies for the physically interesting Lorentzian sector. In many cases, formally, things go through in the physically interesting Lorentzian sector, but of course there are convergence issues and so on. But at the level of rigor that is often assumed in particle physics, one can use the intuition and the framework that has been given by the Euclidean theory to go to the Lorentzian sector. There's a whole bunch of other questions, but they already have been are in the kind of on the web. And they have been beautifully answered by Laura Friedel. And I have given here the web address up here. And Laura's name just appears as L says. And it is there are two contributions from January 23rd, which answer many of the criticisms. I'm not going through here because most of those criticisms were really based on misconceptions and misunderstanding of what people were doing in spin form. Let me just quickly go to a small point about black hole entropy calculation. In the black hole entropy calculation, what is the justification for assuming that the Boltzmann statistics for the puncture? One of the reviews says this explicitly, that one assumes Boltzmann statistics for puncture, and then people have been asking this question. But the answer is that this is a total misconception. In this calculation is very different from the kind of calculation one has in, for example, string theory, where one shows that the physical system of interest has the same number of states as a certain gas of Fermi and Bose particles, and then one does calculations of entropy for the Fermi and Bose particles. Here, the punctures are not to be thought of as particles at all. Here, one has a quantum geometry of the isolated quantum horizon, and it is a general framework. I mean, we set up the framework, and we just calculate the states of this isolated horizon quantum geometry. Now, one may want to think of these particles, these punctures, as particles for some heuristic purposes. And if one wanted to do that, one could reinterpret the calculation, saying that if I were to think of these punctures as particles, then this calculation shows me that the particles have to be treated using Boltzmann statistics. But that is just a reinterpretation of the calculation, not a systematic fundamental derivation. Next, transparency. This is about loop quantum cosmology. Isn't loop quantum cosmology too restrictive because of huge symmetry reduction that is involved? And typically, one is really just has only a finite number of degrees of freedom. And the answer is absolutely, it is too restrictive. And in particular, the inclusion of inhomogeneity is crucial, and this is in fact the focal point of significant current research. However, there are a couple of other points that I would like to mention. One point is that in classical general relativity, there is now mounting evidence for the so-called BKL, Belinsky-Kolesnikov-Lipschitz conjecture. And this conjecture says that if you have space-like singularities, then very near the space-like singularities, the spatial derivatives become negligible, and homogeneity becomes better and better approximation. So this is not a proof by any means, but suggests that homogeneous situations may prove an excellent handle on quantum geometry near space-like singularities. Just to say a little bit more detail, in the space-like singularity, like a Big Bang, the wild curvature is zero, and there, homogeneous isotropic model might be a good model, so to say, to know what is going on in the realistic situation. Inside the black holes, the singularity is such that the wild tensor blows up, and there, the Big Bang model, homogeneous isotropic models, are not very good approximations. There, much better approximations are provided by anisotropic but homogeneous models, and these anisotropic models would be, for example, Bianchi type 1, or other Bianchi types, or the Kondratsky-Sachs model. Finally, the good models, these cosmology models, they provide good intuition and guidance. For example, the recent detailed analytical and numerical studies have provided new insight on constructing the physical sector of the theory, the construction of the Hilbert space, the physical operators, and so on. And this has actually changed the perspective quite a bit from the perspective we had 2 years ago about how to think about the Big Bang singularity. At that stage, we were making statements like, near the Big Bang, the universe turns inside out and so on, somehow something happens to the spatial orientation. And the more careful treatments have shown, because we were able to go to the physical sector, that is quite misleading physically, and the way the singularity is avoided is through a certain quantum bounce, at least in this simple model. And they have revealed interesting features, interesting physics near the Planck domain, for example, this repulsive nature of gravity. So in some ways, this again, making analogy with string theory, in string theory too, one has the ADF-CFT conjecture, which is supposed to be a mathematical physics conjecture for full string theory in certain background space-time. But in practice, one checks this in highly symmetric situations, such as the area space-time itself, or the Penrose limit of waves, and these idealized situations are like the the quantum cosmology model. Okay, so the fourth point was about spin forms, black hole entropy, and loop quantum cosmology. And if there are any comments or questions, let's have a discussion now.
Hi, Abhay. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
This is Casper in Utrecht. I would like to still bring up a point concerning spin foams. This is an issue which Herman and me were very confused about when we wrote our second paper, and about which we expected a lot of response, which somehow didn't come. So I'm raising it here again because I would really like to know the answer to this question. The issue is as follows. You know that spin foams have very much in common with triangulation methods, especially ratchet gravity models. They're not the same, but they certainly share a lot of similar features. And we also know that ratchet gravity, in at least in low dimensions, doesn't reproduce the continuum limits that we can achieve there with analytical methods. Now, this suggests to me that you have to be very careful about the continuum limit for spin foams. And I'm referring here to a paper by Ambjörn in 1997, I think. What I'm surprised about is that...
Can you speak up a little bit? It's hard to hear.
Sorry?
Speak a little louder.
Okay. So I'm concerned about the continuum limit of spin foams, and I'm concerned about the continuum limit because in low dimensions, it has been argued that ratchet models share many features with spin foam models, do not reproduce the continuum limits that we can compute with other means. So I would like to hear your opinion about that point. Should we be worried about that? Is there, or is it somehow avoided with other things which Hiram and me were unable to extract from the literature?
Right. I think it will be best if people who are experts in spin foam first address this question. So Carlo, Alejandro, and Laura, if you are still on the line, please address the question. If you haven't been able to hear it properly, I can repeat it.
Okay. No, I think this is Alejandro. I can try to address the question. In lower dimensional models, spin forms the theory is completely worked out. So this is not an approximation; it's an exact quantization of gravity. There is no relationship to an approximation such as the dynamical triangulation one. So this is what I wanted to say.
Carlo, do you want to add anything?
So you're saying that that in low dimensions, spin foam models reproduce the Kalinichi logic of critical exponents and so on?
The continuum limit in the way I see it in lower dimensional cases of a theory that has that is a topological theory such as 2 plus 1 gravity is quite different from the way you approach it, I think, in dynamical triangulations. In a theory which has a topological degrees of freedom, in my view, in such a theory there is only a finite number of observables, so you can quantize the theory completely and then ask questions in terms of those observables that are available. Of course, the issue is very different in four dimensions where there are local excitations, and then the question of the continuum limit is...
Maybe I should just interrupt you briefly. So the model that I'm talking about, I know that's discussed in this 1997 paper by Ambjörn, two Euclidean dimensions, so not 2 plus 1, and it concerns gravity coupled to matter. But so we're not talking about the topological models in the theory. We're talking about more models which look more like string theory, world sheet models than 2 plus 1 dimensional gravity. It's not pure gravity.
Well, the spin form models in lower dimensions of gravity that are treated in our approach are topological models.
Okay. But do any of you want to add comments about what the expectations are about differences from, for example, the Rajic action and so on in higher dimensions?
Maybe
why the continuum limit there might in spin forms might be better than in than in other models.
Maybe, this is Carlo, maybe I can just repeat, say this in a different way. The fact that spin forms have resemblances with old Regge calculus does not mean that they are the same thing. And in particular, the definition of the quantum theory is completely different. In what Amjon has been doing for a long time, there is the idea that there is a short scale, that there is a structure, which is the triangulation has a scale, and the theory is defined in the limit in which the scale goes to zero. So there is a large number of problems that comes out from that. In the spin form, the physics is completely different. The physics is sort of dictated by the fact that from, at least this is the way I view it, we have learned from the canonical theory that there is a discrete scale. So we are describing the theory in terms of the exact states in the kinematical theory. So we have described the theory in terms of states which are discrete in the small and have a scale which is basically Planck scale. So the size of the triangulation does not go to zero. So the questions are different. Those specific questions, what happens in the continuum limit in which the size of the triangulation is taken to zero, are not at all present here. This is it. So I think this is those particular problems are not relevant in the spin-form context as I see it.
Any further comments about either this point or any other point? Okay, let us go to the last part, which is the fifth part and the shortest part. And this, I think in the previous few parts, I tried to give what I believe is a general opinion, general consensus. Of course, the detailed way in which I formulated the responses are my own and may not be shared by some other people in the community. But the general message I was trying to convey was what I think is shared by a wide part of the community. The last part is a very short part, and here I just give my personal answer to a certain question that is often asked. And this is the fifth question, which is a general question. There are typos here. I mean loop quantum gravity and not loop quantum cosmology. Are loop quantum gravity and string theory two versions of the same theory, or are they mutually incompatible? And my personal answer is neither. They're certainly not two versions of the same theory, in the sense, for example, that we had a Pauli treatment of the hydrogen atom in terms of beautiful SO4 structure of operator, and the Schrodinger treatment of the hydrogen atom, which was in terms of wave functions, namely Schrodinger equation. So this is not just the equivalent thing. Or another example would be what happened in the early days of quantum electrodynamics. One had a Schwinger treatment in terms of operators, and one had Feynman treatment in terms of Feynman diagrams, which then later on became the path integral approach. But they were equivalent, as Dyson showed. However, so in our case, I think that the two theories are not at all kind of equivalent, just two sides of the same coin. However, I believe that both the theories at this current stage are very incomplete, but they have very different basic assumptions. And somehow this basic assumption is actually healthy because it lets us probe complementary aspects of the general problems of quantum gravity. For example, we have background independence and quantum geometry in loop quantum gravity. And these ideas are likely to be extremely helpful in whatever the final theory there would be. Somehow the idea that there is a fundamental discreteness of a precise type, which is not just postulated by hand, but does not just say that I want there to be, you know, so many sprinkling of points and I want the volume to be just the number of points that I sprinkled and so on, but rather things which came from a detailed analysis starting from the phase space of general relativity or supergravity. So we had this quantum geometry, and I think that this is likely to find its place, someplace in the final theory. But as of now, loop quantum gravity certainly does not have any grand strategy for unification. The strategy that is given by string theory has not entirely succeeded. I mean, we don't seem to find any compactification or any low-energy theory which really reproduces the universe around us, which has no supersymmetry and certain number of generations of particles and certain spectrum of particles, etc., etc. And certainly there is no control on the masses of the particles. But still, it's a very attractive idea that all particles are born out of quantum excitations of a same of a fundamental entity, a string. And so some such idea is likely to remain, I think, in the final theory. And also, we might be able to understand, or in fact use, a lot of perturbative techniques which are there in string theory. I think if one understands better, for example, the propagator and the correlation functions that Carlo mentioned earlier in this discussion, and one wants to do perturbation calculations in detail, it may well be that one would have to start out with a quantum geometry which resembles Minkowski space, or if it is, or in the Hamiltonian language, it could be a state of a quantum geometry which would be peaked at a spatially flat geometry and zero extrinsic curvature. And one would have such a state, and on this state, one would like to do perturbation theory. So such a state would have some inbuilt graphs, and edges of these graphs could look like strings, and perturbations of these edges of the graphs could be treated using the could be treated like one does the perturbations in string theory. This would be feasible because there will be background geometry because one is doing perturbation theory around a given background. So one could learn things from techniques from string theory, perturbative techniques from string theory, also in loop quantum gravity. So I particularly personally always feel that I never feel that there is a it is one or the other. I feel that the two theories are really complementary. However, misconceptions can arise and do arise because the two approaches start with very different starting points and they use very different languages. For example, we are using languages of Hilbert spaces, operators, spin forms, and as Carlo mentioned, we're not taking the standard continuum limit and so on. Whereas in string theory, one is doing often in Euclidean space path integrals. One is more interested in the Riemann surfaces, conformal field theories, etc., etc. And it is really not easy to translate one set of techniques or one set of results from one language to another language. If one had a physical result which was finished, then it might be possible, but at the moment, physical results are rather few. For example, as far as I know, one cannot compare and contrast in any direct sense the singularity resolution in loop quantum gravity, which is coming from either black holes or cosmology, symmetry reductions, and singularity resolutions in string theory, which is often coming from tachyon condensations and such concepts. It's not easy to translate one thing, one set of ideas to the other set of ideas. But I think, in spite of the fact that the translation is non-trivial, the variety of ideas is extremely good. And I always like to quote this advice that Feynman gave. He spoke to a bunch of young people on his way at CERN on his way back from Stockholm when he just received the Nobel Prize. And he said that it is very important that we do not all follow the same fashion. It is necessary to increase the amount of variety, and the only way to do it is to implore a few of you guys, to take a risk. I think taking risks and going in different directions, following one's gut feelings, is very, very important. Okay, again, I will stop here, and we can have first any comments or discussion on this last part, and then we can also have a more global discussion for a few minutes. So, comments or discussion about this last part, about the possible relations between string theory and loop quantum gravity. Okay, are there any comments or questions about the whole subject? Points that I have not covered, for example, questions about various things?
Bye.
Yeah.
Carlo. Let me stop there. Two things. First, can you send us a mail with exact reference of this Feynman so I can use it next time we have the money for the...
Yeah, it is. Okay, I'll do that.
And second, there's a comment perhaps I should have made before regarding the use of the Euclidean theory, Riemannian theory. Your discussion was mostly in the framework of questions from the outside, in a
yes.
sense. So I just wanted to add one of my own motivations for being so interested in the Riemannian theory, which it's sort of a motivation for me. I don't know how much it's defendable publicly, but I sort of believe it. Which is that it is true that the standard Vick rotation, it's for many reasons we all know, not good in general relativity. It doesn't work for a number of reasons. But I still thinking that some sort of Vick rotation should be possible, and of course there were many attempts in the past and many ideas. So I would be surprised if, in a sense, all of quantum field theory can be done in the Euclidean and then continued back to the physical Lorentzian sector, and this wouldn't be true for background independent theories. Because there are a lot of ideas on the market how to do it. For instance, continue in G00 rather than T and others. But in a sense, I still think that it's far from impossible that at the end of the day, if we had a consistent Riemannian theory where things can be computed for real, then from that we could define a Lorentzian theory which makes sense. That's it.
Yeah, I agree with you that this is a possibility and. Not in the spin, not in spin form models, but in the Hamiltonian picture, this was kind of technically may even be feasible, as was suggested by Thomas Thiemann and then by me, by the so-called generalized Vick transform, that one might be able to actually solve the. I mean, in the classical theory, one can do this. One might be able to actually solve the constraint equations in the Euclidean theory. And then do a generalized Vick rotation on the space of the solution to the Lorentzian theory. And these ideas have been around for a little while, but somehow they are not received enough attention. And I think that this is just an example, but such ideas, I think, are definitely fruitful directions. I mean, the problem in loop quantum gravity always is that there are not enough people to pursue all the potentially interesting ideas. But I agree with you, and this is a good point. I've just jotted down one other point, and that had to do with the frequently asked questions about cosmology. There are two points. The one was that this question comes from an early paper, by that I mean a couple of years ago, I think 2004 if I remember, by Green and Unruh, which was titled Difficulties with Loop Quantum Cosmology. Loop quantum cosmology, in which they had considered homogeneous isotropic k equal to 1 model closed cosmology. Then the closed cosmology, what in classical theory, there is a big bang, the universe expands, reaches a maximum size, and then recollapses again. And they had used what was then the standard framework are available, the loop quantum cosmology equations that were in the literature, and done some numerical work, and they found that the recollapse did not occur. So they showed some concern that while singularity might be resolved, at large scales, the collapse may not occur, so one would have disagreement with general relativity. More recent and much more careful analysis has shown that this is not true. There is actually a recollapse. It will be too technical to go into details about that, but I just wanted to tell you that this objection doesn't exist anymore. And the last thing that is much more common in, again, various reviews and articles, is that somehow the singularity resolution is because of a key fact, namely that in the isotropic homogeneous model, the inverse volume operator is bounded above. And then the argument goes that in the full theory, the inverse volume operator is not bounded above, and therefore this prediction is not trustable. But again, the more detailed analysis that have recently been done, in which the physical sector of the theory, the physical Hilbert space and Dirac observables, etc., were constructed, because one could do things numerically, we also allowed for the possibility of just using the naive inverse of the volume operator, which is unbounded from above, and none of the features, qualitative features, that we have, which, for example, the resolution of the singularity and the big bounds and so on, are affected. So it is just a misconception, in part because of the way that the early quantum cosmology papers were written, that inverse volume is essential, boundedness of inverse volume is essential for resolution of the singularity. Okay, I would like to end unless there are last-minute comments or questions from anyone. Okay, so thanks very much, and we meet again next week at the same time when Carlo is going to tell us there is a series of two talks, first by Carlo, then by Simone, on the recent work on graviton propagator. I hope that Carlo will sort of start not too technically and tell us the general conceptual setting and how the calculations are set up, etc., and then Simone would be able to give us more detail. Thank you very much.